soon as you get a country that is consuming what it produces, you have a country that's in a process of becoming independent, of becoming autonomous, of becoming free.
Là, la Russie, elle veut faire ça en ce moment. Mm-hmm. Il faut un programme pour l'agriculture, pour le développement.
Yeah. That's why Western press hates Russia. That's why they attack Russia, because Russia has said, well, like this to the World Trade Organization, we're going to produce for ourselves. Russia is one of the most important threats to world empire right now. China is another important threat to world empire. And the United States is the ultimate threat to world empire.
Well, it's funny you guys mentioned these countries, just because we didn't talk much about it today, but if we just want to get back to something, I wanted to talk to, maybe we got lost a little bit, but the thing is, there is a plan right now to return to sanity, which is advancing. It's moving along pretty nicely. But you also have insanity into what the Secretary of Treasury in the United States is doing in trying to bail out everything that's bankrupt.
Correct.
Right. It's trying to bail. And before we get into, I don't know if we'll be able to go to this question of the Glass-Steagall, because there's two things. There's LaRouche's plan, which is a three-step plan, which involves the four-power solution to have Russia, China, and India join the United States to create a new fixed exchange rate system, a credit system of fixed exchange rates and low interest rates for infrastructure development. That's one, which is the part of the three-point plan that LaRouche has to keep people in their homes in the United States and freeze the whole debt. And then once you've done that, to go see the four-power solution. But the other thing is that he added this after the fact, but we have a very important law that was repealed in 1999 under Bill Clinton,
which was
Glass-Steagall.
Oh.
And this was a law dating from 1933, which basically separated the activities of a commercial bank from investment banks. Okay, and that we might read this paper if we have time. But before that, I just thought we could read this latest slug, because every day on the website we have these.
Can you make it, please?
Yeah, we have these news. News items that show up on the website, and maybe we can get somebody to read that. Anybody want to read that?
What is Mocktail?
Huh?
Mockal.
Where are you looking at this?
The first line.
Oh, Amok. Amok is going Amok. Crazy, or just go wild.
Okay.
You want to read?
It is the derivative, stupid. Derivatives, the hyperinflation bomb crushing the international financial system.
Sorry, can I just... It's just hard to understand.
You don't like my accent.
It's just... Is it hard?
I read it slow.
Okay, we can read at the same time.
Yeah,
so okay.
Okay.
You can follow up, okay? You can correct me.
Okay.
LaRouche, is the derivative stupid? October 9, 2008, LaRouche Park. Linda LaRouche today, mock Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, bailout scheme. Warning that Paulson and all of other central bankers have been lying through their teeth about their over-changing so-called bailout swindles. The real problem that none of them wish to talk about is the massive derivatives obligation that are in quadrillions of dollars. LaRouche called the derivatives bubble the hyperinflationary bomb, crushing the international financial system. Warning. Until you just shut down the whole derivatives trade white gambling obligation of the book of the financial system, you are just kidding yourself. LaRouche declared. It is time to break the silence on derivatives. The true hyperinflationary factor in the situation is the unregulated, insane leverage derivative trade. This is what is killing us. This is a great crime of Alan Greenspan. According to the most recent data released June 30, 2008, by the office, the controller of the currency, the three larger American bank holding company, JP Morgan, Chase, Bank of America, and Citigroup, had currently outstanding derivatives contract totaling $179.4 trillion. The three banks combined have total assets just under $5.6 trillion. Okay. The entire gross domestic product of the United States is $11 trillion. Okay, at the December 31st, 2007, according to the Bank of International Settlement, the total over-the-counter and exchange-traded derivatives total more than $675 trillion. However, these authorities figure out, according to the Executive Intelligence Review analyst John Heufel, grossly understated. The true figure, Hoffel estimated, are well above $250 billion. LaRouche concluded, unless and until you deal with the derivatives bubble, which cannot and should not be bailed out, you are all just kidding yourself. It is time Hank Paulson to swallow the only real medicine, bankruptcy reorganization of the entire dollar-based financial system. And the first step in any such bankruptcy reorganization will be the cancellation of these quadrillions of dollars in pure gambling obligations. Without such a faction, the planet is doomed to a horrible dark age, just like the dark age of the 14th century that followed the collapse of the Lombard banking system.
Now, I'm worried, because this is LaRouche speaking, it's not just anybody speaking. And when he talks about potential 14th century dark age, sounds like impossible. It sounds like too big, like not going to happen to us kind of thing, right? But then again, remember, that's the same guy who said the German or the Russian economy was going to collapse. And it did.
Yeah, but then it's like, it's just a little part. It's just like finger that you cut, if you'd say that the Russian economy would collapse, but no, you're talking about the whole world. I mean,
what is the way that he's thinking?
But the thing is, the currency of Mexico just collapsed 25% over the last 2 weeks. You know, what this mean about living standard in Mexico? The thing is, this is happening now. The living standard are collapsing as a result of financial policy.
They're trying to bail out billions of dollars which don't exist. So, what does that do to the value of real dollars?
You've got economists around the world that are realizing that, and you've got people that are aware. I mean, you've got
we got to organize.
The question to consider, though, is
more.
Well, I think it's true what you say that the world the majority of people in the world do not want the whole system to collapse.
Even the oligarchs.
Even the oligarchs.
They want.
That's true.
They want to be able
but the
to
crucial question,
take
the crucial
private
question.
Jet and do whatever they want.
But the crucial question is, what will these people be willing to give up in order to ensure that civilization continues for humanity? Do you think that these people in control are capable of sacrificing themselves to save humanity? Because that's what we're really talking about. We're not just talking about people who are trying to do the right thing to save the system, or to save humanity. We're talking about people who, in order to do what LaRouche says has to be done, have to go from being, insanely wealthy to being a bum.
Obama.
No, not
Obama. Give him $1 million. We're gonna put him
a dignified human being working with a real job, creative.
In their minds, they're gonna become bums because you're gonna go from owning $1 trillion to owning maybe only a million, right?
Maybe just owning your home.
What do you think happens when you say $1 quadrillion?
These are the facts. You've got people like you've got your private challenger. You've got your $40 million boat. You've got big mansion around the world, and that's it. You've got to lose it.
You see, the thing is, well, somebody own or believe could he own these quadrillions of dollars. That's what the problem is. The interesting thing is this quadrillions of dollars doesn't exist. Like the comparison they're giving about United States, you know, this is 10 times the gross domestic product of United States. You know, the thing is this money, this debt cannot be paid. You know, you have to stop, take everything, nobody eat and everything produced in the United States gonna be used to pay the debt. But what does this mean, pay the debt?
Okay, but basically it's all the system which is corrupt, the way that we produce things, the way we produce chairs, the material we use.
No, it's not the real problem. The real problem, okay, is when you believe in money that has money, because when you believe that money is money in itself,
no, money is value.
Yeah, well, that money is the value, then you're insane, because then you stop thinking about how you created the value, right?
Mm-hmm. But it's just the way we consume, the way we produce things now. It's
no,
not sustainable.
That's not the problem. That's not the problem.
He's making a very important point.
Sorry.
You know, what is money? What the money represents is piece of paper, right? Who virtually doesn't have any value by itself. It's just piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot eat it. You know, have marks on it, so you cannot use it to make notes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you cannot use it for nothing. Okay. But the question is, what is who gives a value to this money? Okay.
Let's pause a second.
Yes.
Let's pause a second, because we're asking the question, what is money? I'm willing to say that money can fluctuate in the value depending on the political decisions that are made, depending what kind of value we give to that money. But now, let's see this point. This is where it gets interesting to include the Glass-Steagall bill, because you have a law that became necessary because you started to have wise guys in the 1929 Depression time. These people, talking about J. Pierpont Morgan companies in the United States, Goldman Sachs, and all that. And maybe, I don't know if you have your paper that we read today, but this is something interesting that we should study, because you get to see how people have created a very virtual or a mathematical way of creating money. And they think, you can keep it, they think that the way that they've discovered, so to speak, in the way they might speak, they think that the way they've created this system of creating value or creating money out of thin air, they believe that money actually is valuable, okay? And I don't know how familiar everybody is with what the term leverage means when you say you have when companies use leveraging or to create money.
Is that buying assurance?
No, that's different. It's different. You have derivatives, which is more of the insurance, which is gambling insurances for your bad bets. But the principle of leveraging is explained very interestingly here, and I think we should read that.
Can you read just a minute?
Yeah, I can read it. This author, this was from an article that was in the EIR in 1999. A month after Bill Clinton had just signed on this Graham Leach Bliley Financial Modernization Act. They called it the Financial Modernization Act, which was basically the law that repealed Glass-Steagall. Okay, and Glass-Steagall is just the name of the two senators which were part of the
decree.
We could create some, we could print some more.
Can you give them a copy?
Or you want to give your...
Yeah.
Actually, I can probably find it here, because it's on the website, so that's always useful.
To see how this operated.
You want to start reading that part where he's talking about...
Yeah.
The
he's
example?
Talking about, this is in the chapter talking about the story of Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs investigated. And it's all within the context of the Fletcher-Pecora hearings that were begun by President Hoover and which were continued and completed with Roosevelt and which resulted in the Glass-Steagall Act. Okay? And basically, the Glass-Steagall Act requires that that different banking practices stay separate. You cannot be a commercial bank and an investment bank.
Not to corrupt your your assets.
Right. If you're a commercial bank, you cannot engage in speculation. Okay. You are responsible for collecting deposits. For payrolls, for loans of a specific type towards development, and with the one exception that you're allowed to issue insurance for government-issued bonds, or you're allowed to have involvement in that. If you're an investment bank, you're not allowed to take deposits. And neither the investment bank nor the commercial bank can have anything to do with insurance. These three activities must remain separate. This is Glass-Steagall. Okay?
I'm going to put it on here. The part where he says, to see how this operated.
Yeah, I'll read the one just before that.
Okay.
The investment trusts.
Okay.
So this is how leverage works. Okay? I'm going to start up with the key to Goldman Sachs performance. Yeah. The key to Goldman Sachs performance was the fervor with which it used leverage. The multiplier effect of leverage has been likened to cracking a whip. A certain force in the snap of the wrist can result in many multiples of that force being discharged at the whip's end. To get this snap, Goldman Sachs used investment trusts. These are simply corporations that don't do anything productive, but obtain their value by buying the stocks of other companies and holding on to them. After World War II, these investment trusts soon merged into their very close cousins, which we today know as mutual funds. The investment trusts work on the principle that through leverage, they could conjure up vast amounts of fictitious value, thereby enriching themselves, that they would cause their own common stock price to increase in value at a higher rate of growth than that of the common stock of other companies that they were holding. To see how this operated, let us create an imaginary investment trust, which will operate very much as Goldman Sachs investment trusts actually did. We can call this investment trust A. In order to operate, investment trust A must have some cash. To obtain cash, it sells its own paper. Let us say that investment trust A obtains $150 million worth of cash by issuing $150 million of its own paper. $50 million of its own bonds, $50 million of its own preferred stock, and $50 million of its own common stock. So here you have three different types of paper, all included in this 100.
Three species of paper.
Three species of paper, yes. After the sale of its own instruments, Investment Trust A uses the $150 million in cash to buy the common stock of other companies, such as AT&T, Ford, GM, and U.S. Steel. These stocks are now called Investment Trust A's assets. If one is operating during the 1929, prior to the crash, one can expect the price of the common stock that one owns to go up. Assume all common stocks rise, on average, by 50% in value. Then, the assets that Investment Trust A owns, which were worth $150 million, would now be worth $225 million. If the value of Investment Trust A's assets are worth $225 million, then the value of the paper that Investment Trust A has issued, its bonds, preferred stock, and common stock, should reflect this increase by also being worth $225 million.
Makes sense.
Here's how the first level of leverage comes in.
You have to laugh at this. It's pretty silly. Eh?
The value of the bonds and preferred stock...
Comprends-tu un peu? Ok, donc on a jusqu'à maintenant établi...
Est-ce que tu peux imprimer parce que ce sera peut-être plus facile. Je l'ai mis sur l'écran, mais j'ai un problème. Tu peux checker.
Mais j'en ai une copie ici.
Mais sinon, on peut le regarder depuis le site.
Oui, oui. On va te donner une copie. C'est facile.
Là, je viens.
J'ai toujours...
Tu veux le faire jour. Non, le soir.
Parce qu'on a l'ouvrir la table. On a commencé ici. Là, on est rendu un peu...
Let me... situate. Okay, we want to know what leverage is. So we start with an investment company called A.
Okay.
The investment company A starts off with nothing. It doesn't produce anything. It's just an empty company. But this company will need money to operate. So it's going to sell some paper. There's different ways that it's going to create paper.
So it's me, I'm the company A.
Yeah, so you're selling $50 million worth of bonds. Bonds is basically a contract giving an expiry date on the bond, so that after 1 year, let's say, or 50 years or whatever, you have an interest that will be paid for all the time that the money that was put in the bond was there.
But don't explain it too much.
Yes.
There's three species.
So there's three species. You have the bonds, the $50 million of preferred stock, and the $50 million of the common stock. So the company starts off with $150 million of cash that it got from people, and the people got paper. The only thing the company gave was paper, a guarantee, a contract. Okay? Now, the investment company A now has $150 million of cash. It goes to the stock market and buys $150 million of assets of real companies. Companies like GM, IBM, whatever.
AT&T.
US.
Like I would do with my mutual funds.
Yeah.
At each year.
Well, the mutual fund, don't confuse by saying mutual fund right now. But we'll see what it is soon. But the real companies are the ones that produce things, real production. Okay, let's leave it at that for now, and then I think we move on.
But the company A, I can buy bonds from the company A.
Yes.
Yeah.
Moi, je pas de travail, mais je peux te vendre 150 millions de dollars de papiers de promesses parce que je suis un bon gars. Je vais acheter des papiers de moi, on va créer une compagnie qui s'appelle Yuko, et je vais te la vendre, je vais te promettre que je vais te payer des intérêts. C'est un papier. Yuko Dimo, compagnie de science-fiction, on va te vendre, tu vas recevoir ce papier, et dans 3 ans, je vais te payer 5% des intérêts.
Okay.
La compagnie, elle se décrit comment
Is it stock market? Is it mutual fund?
This is what used to be called investment trust.
This is how it works. This is prior to 1929.
This is before there's laws. Okay? That's describing.
Before, but the principle is the same as today. It's worse today. Anyway, let's go on.
Yeah.
So basically, you start up an investment bank. You're not producing anything. So you sell paper in order to generate money so that you can invest. After all, you're an investment bank. You have to invest.
But you'd be more attractive than buying directly from GM.
Yeah, but this is why, okay?
Okay.
So we're going to get on to that. So
you're selling your salad so that it becomes more attractive for me.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's got to be a trick,
no,
right?
No problem.
Why would you want to have...
We got it taken care of. So, 50 million bonds, 50 million preferred stock, fill 50 million common stock. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Make money. Great.
Now, here's how the first level of leverage comes in. The value of the bonds and preferred stock that a company originally has issued does not change much, except if there is a change in interest rates. Investment Trust A originally issued $50 million worth of bonds and $50 million worth of preferred stock. They will still be worth roughly $50 million apiece. Thus, the only paper that Investment Trust A issued that could rise in value is its common stock. Since the total value of Investment Trust A's financial paper is now worth $225 million, then the value of the common stock that Investment Trust A issued must have risen in value from $50 million before to $125 million now. Okay. Because remember before, the company invests in real companies, and their stock rose 50%. So now instead of 150 million, it's worth 225 million.
Okay.
Because GM and
okay. The bonds. There's three species. The whole point of the scheme, right, is to confuse the issue, right. And to introduce sophistry.
Yeah.
So you say you're going to sell $50 million of bonds, which is true. That's what you intend to do. But the thing is, the bonds, they have a small interest rate, let's say. And over a year, maybe the bonds will still be $50 million, maybe plus or like a little bit more. But basically, it will stay the same. And that's the only money that the people investing in the bonds are hoping to get back. But it's a better guarantee than the common stock. Because don't forget, we're assuming that the markets will go up, but it can always go bad. Right?
If the real companies don't make their numbers.
Well, if the whole economy of the United States collapses.
So, like, the banks, like, reassure people from the money take, like, the market is going up and you sure that they're going to make money, right?
Well, this is where you see the going along to get along.
Without getting too complicated, let's just read a little quicker because the idea is of leverage. We're thinking about leveraging, okay? So, basically, $150 million invested.
But just explain the preferred stock.
Okay.
Preferred stock is when you have, I have a company, I'm going to emit these stocks, and to my friends, I'm going to sell it a lot cheaper. Let's say the stocks are selling for $37, I'm going to sell to my friends for $20 before they're even emitted, before they're even sold on by the other people.
I'm going to sell them for 27, and it's worth
$37. Let's say, yeah. So a lot less money. But the thing is, the only hope of making money from the people who buy the preferred stock is because they know they have a bargain price on the when they buy it. So if they sell it almost immediately, they'll be guaranteed to make money. And then the rest of the money of the increase, if this increases by 50% of the value, then all of these people are not going to see the increase, because they're investing knowing that there's a certain guarantee that they're going to get. But these people will get all the profit that these people are not able to collect because they're already on a contract. That these people will not collect because they already have a preferred stock deal. But all this stock will now... Is that... Did we read up to that point yet?
Yep.
Okay. So all these stocks will increase... Is these increase 50%? And this one... Then this one increase 50% overall. Right? Overall is 50%. But 50% of 150 million is 75 million. So 75 million plus 150 is 225.
To be shared amongst everyone, yeah.
But not these ones, because they're already on the contract. Not these ones, because they already have the preferred stock. So only these ones will be sharing the extra profit. So it actually is like this has increased 150% because now it's a...
We're getting to that.
Yeah, okay.
So do you have the idea? Basically, there's three types of paper that they're selling, right? Three species of paper. But the only one that can go up or down, because the others have guarantees, is the common stock. Okay.
I want to buy bonds. It's because I want to save investment.
Save.
I don't want to make. I'm only sure that I want
no
make
headaches.
Money. That's
yeah.
it.
Preferred stock. You may not even have the opportunity to buy because you're not a friend of the bank. Preferred stock is for special people. It's a discount price for stock. Okay.
It's legal.
I don't know. I don't know if it's legal or not, but this is the way it works. So when you have 150 million in real stock, that is AT&T, GM, US Steel, and so on, and that stock goes up 50%, then the value of all of your paper, because you didn't just invest the 50 million, you invested all of 150 million, the value of that paper becomes 225 million. But the catch is that only the common stock moves. So now the bonds, still worth 50 million. The preferred stock, still worth 50 million. All of a sudden, the common stock is worth 125 million.
And if the company would have made less money, well, the bonds would have
been... Yeah, but that's not the important point. The important point is that they've created an illusion, right? The total investment...
Erase it on the ledge.
Okay? The total investment is 150 million, right? Here, 150 mil. Okay? That's the total investment, right? It goes up 50%, right? To make it 225 million, right? So far, so good. But these don't go up. That's still worth 50. That's still worth 50. That's 100 together, right? So minus 100 million equals 125 million for their common stock. Right? Is that right?
Yes.
Right? You have 100 million, which is the bonds
and
plus
preferred.
Okay? These two. Bonds plus preferred. What's left over is 125 million of your new value, right? So the common stock goes from 50 million, from 50 million to 125 million.
And if the company would have lost money, the common stocks would
that's
have
right.
been the loser.
That's
so
right.
That's
so
far it's fair.
Yeah, no, it's fair by the numbers. But the illusion is that even though these stocks here, US Steel, Okay, real stocks. This goes up 50%. But how much did this go up? What is the percentage here?
125
million, right? Or 150%. Mm-hmm. Or no, 150. Right, it goes up 50 mm-hmm. plus 25, that's 150%. So all of a sudden, the common stock in investment company A goes up 150%.
Now, sorry, if I'm reading my newspaper and all these companies are listed next to each other, which company am I going to put my money in?
Are you going to put your money in GM, which went up 50%? Or are you going to put your money in investment company A, people, 150% returns here, three times? That's called leverage.
But it's not finished. We're not done yet.
Because it's very good.
Everything is fine so far. I don't see the problem.
Yes, we don't see the problem. We are ready to invest. Keep going. You are far to be a stock broker, man.
Patrick has a question.
I don't understand the three species of paper. You mean bonds are money from people who invest in this bank, right?
It's all money from people who are investing in this bank. But the difference is that bonds, because of their special guarantee, do not get the people are not part of the gambling process. Okay.
They won't lose.
Okay. They don't lose.
Preferred stock.
The gains that you get are in the fact that you're getting a discount price on the stock.
Okay. But if it goes down, the preferred stock would lose as well.
If it goes down significantly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. And what about the comments? Where does the money go? Is it from the owners of the bank?
Well, no. It's sold to the public. This is all sold to the public. But the important idea is that when you have a 50% increase in real value of real companies, it translates into a 150% increase in the value of the stock of this company.
Through this method of leverage.
Yeah, the leveraging. Now, if you take all the numbers together, you could say, oh, well, it's the same numbers, you're just kind of shifting them around. But, okay, notice what happened. The value of the assets, the common stock of other companies that investment A owns, increased in value by 50%. But the value of investment trust A's own common stock increased in value by 150%, from 50 million to 125 million. That is, at a rate three times greater than the common stock of other companies that investment trust A owns. This constitutes leverage. In this example, the ratio of leverage is 3:1 between the increase in value of common stock and its production of a threefold increase in the value of investment trust A, which owns these stocks. In each case, some multiple of leverage is at work. Okay. The blindly ambitious would not stop there. Assume that one could further set up an investment trust B that would buy up and hold the common stock of investment trust A. Investment trust B would issue bonds, preferred stock, common stock, etc. Investment trust B's value would increase by a leverage multiple upon the increase in value of investment trust A, which itself increased by a leverage multiple upon the increase of the common stock of other companies which it held. If the leverage of investment trust A to the common stocks it held was 3, and the leverage of the investment trust B to the investment trust A was 3, then the leverage of investment trust B to the common stock in the portfolio of investment trust A was 9.
Where do you want to invest? You want to invest in trust B or trust A?
It's a bit difficult for me.
Have you lost the train?
Yeah, a bit.
Okay.
Well, I think I'll be with it at home and I'll.
Okay, we're gonna we're going to do this all again. Okay, the same idea. But this time, it's investment trust B. Okay? Investment trust B issues bonds, issues preferred stock, and issues common stock. Let's say they do it the same way as investment trust A, so that the leverage is the same.
But sorry, investment B buys from investment A.
Buys only the common stock.
Stocks. Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. But then splits, let's see. Yeah, it raises enough money to buy the common stock of investment trust A. Okay? But let's say it invests $50 million to buy that common stock, right? But it splits it in three again. So that a third of it is in bonds, a third of it is in preferred stock, and only a third of it is in common stock. Like investment trust A, the bonds and the preferred stock don't move. Only the common stock moves. The value of the total assets of investment trust B at the beginning is going to be $50 million, right? But only the third of it that's invested in common stock, that's split into common stock, is going to move. So of a $50 million investment, right, we already know that this one didn't go up 50%. The original stocks went up 50%, but this went up 150%. Okay?
Can we just restate it? Okay.
Yeah. Let's put it here.
So now you have B purchasing A, which purchases company at GM. U.S. Steel,
etc.
IBM.
Yeah. So remember, this went up 50%. So, and we saw that they had three outlets. It had the bonds, the preferred, and the common stock. This stayed the same. This stayed the same. This went up 150%.
Yes.
And so, if this B company uses its money, or using its different stocks,
so like this way, let's just pretend that all of these companies were created at the same time, okay? So, investment trust A, you know, it raises this much money through selling this this paper, okay? $50 million of which is in common stocks. B buys that. So A's original investment is $150 million. Okay, B's original investment is $50 million. Okay, it buys up all the common stock of A.
Okay.
Again, it has bonds worth a third of 50. Which is in the neighborhood of, let's say, 17,
15. Yes.
Okay. Let's say the bonds are a 16 mil. Right. The preferred is 16 mil. It's 32, and the common stock is 18 mil. So for a total of 50 mil. Now, the common stock went up 150% went from 50 to now is worth 125 million. Okay? Right? So now the total assets of B must go up to 125 million, right?
Because it invested in A's common stock. Okay.
A's common stock invested this time. But, like A, this one doesn't move. This one remains at 16. This one doesn't move. This one remains at 16. So what does this have to be worth in order to add up to 125?
125 minus 20.
Well,
133.
This is 32 million, right?
32 minus
125 minus 32 million. And you're talking 93 million now. Ooh, a tidy little profit.
Okay, but where does the money of the common stock go? Like, you're saying all of these species of paper go into the public?
No.
What are you saying?
That's what
you're saying. Are you saying that this is... What are you saying? What do you mean, where does it go? It's right there.
Okay.
It's 93 million, man.
Well, now he has a paper that's worth... That says it's worth something.
Okay.
It's worth the value compounded. And now you take this paper and you go sell it.
To somebody else.
You use it as collateral to get a loan.
No, but do you understand what they just described here?
Yeah, well.
Okay, so it's $93 million.
Yeah, now it is.
Because the stock of General Motors is making cars, a good company.
Okay.
The first guys invested, he won. I invested in his company and I won much more.
It's great until it collapsed. Because
it's
when the money is there, GM and IBM, and it feeds the system, so far there's no scam, there's no like...
But the thing is, where the money is used, you're using money, you're saying you're going to invest it, but really what are you doing? You're confusing the economy, you're stealing the real value of the people, you're cheapening the lives of the workers at GM,
okay.
You're enriching the people who are living off the work of the people who work at GM. You're stealing people's lives or their work, and you're using it for your gain. So this is oligarchism. You don't have to be from an ancient family, but it's a culture flaw when you think you can put yourself above in a higher class where you don't have to work.
Yeah.
You see, the problem is what's happened if you have a physical process, like having cows, making cars. What's happening is the real profit, the real development. You know, a cow can give you birth one a year. You have to wait for a couple of months for the potatoes to grow and the tomatoes to grow. What's happening is require hard work. You can make tomatoes, you can sell the tomatoes, you can make some profit. But this profit is 10-15% maximum. Okay, these guys are talking to you about how much is 93 compared to 18. This is 300-400%. So suddenly for you, if you're an honest person, say, listen, you know, I'm working my ass here. You know, I'm having this farm and this land here. If I sell all this land, kill the cows and sell the meat, I take $100,000 to $1 million, $2 million. If I invest in the stock market, I'm going to be making tripling and quadrupling my money much faster than if I work. You see?
Yeah.
So this means an investment, a building bridge, a building school, building hospital, building roads, highway, because not attractive for a private capital, because it's not giving you any profit for 5 or 10 years. Okay, until you build it, you start getting your returns back in this kind of thing, even if you have a guarantee. So what, you're going to get 5% returns, so what's the deal here, okay? Suddenly, the capital is going over there where you can make much more profit. So this is like a vacuum cleaner, increasing the money in circulation and taking it away from the physical economy. That's where the trick is.
So after a while, those companies like GM, IBM, and Union They won't make money because the RD wasn't there, because they had nothing.
Well, listen to this.
There's one more thing going on here. Ask yourself the question. You heard what Ilko described in terms of what these companies are doing, right? U.S. GM, U.S. Steel, Farmers Dairy or whatever. You can understand the process of what they're doing. There was nothing. They worked hard. They created something. What are these companies doing? Is there an actual generation of wealth in anything that these people are doing?
Physical wealth. Does the fact that they invest in
it's just paper, right? You said about but what happens to all this money? You were like, and I was like, what are you talking about, pal? Kind of drink. You just made, you know, 450% profit. Right?
But on paper.
Put me on paper.
Now, what happens? What happens when the people who own this stock, which used to be worth 18 million bucks, now say, okay, give me the 93. Meanwhile, this company has gone up 50% from 150 million to 225 million. Right? What happens if this and this say, okay, give me the money?
Are they allowed to ask for the money?
They earned it, man. They invested.
Okay. So,
well,
yeah, what happens?
Give me the money. Give me the money.
The money
well,
is there. The money
125
is
there. Plus 93, you're looking at, you know, 218 million off of that, leaving 7 million left for the physical economy out of the original 150 million investment. Now there's only 7 million left. And that doesn't include the people who own this and this. In fact, there's less than zero left in here.
93 divided by 18 is 5.16.
Yeah, 500%.
500%, eh?
Whatever. That's pretty good, eh? But if you look and you start adding this up, what's this worth? That's not worth 125 million. What's this worth? This is worth 225 million. Wait a minute, 225 million is the whole thing here. So this is actually how much the physical economy is in the whole now.
Can you repeat the last thing?
Well, what happens if all these people want their money now? These people already want 225 million. This is 225. Whoa, this is 125 over here. What's 125 plus 225? To me, that's 350.
350.
Oof. This is only worth 225 million at the base. So all of a sudden you have people calling assets. People who are in the who are totally out of the realm of production. Who, through their entire activity for the whole year, produce less than nothing because they are eating. They are eating, so they're using up physical economy.
They're driving
eating.
Cars.
They're driving cars.
They're traveling.
They're going to restaurants. They're, you know, whatever. They're doing lots of stuff. But this whole profit here comes out of a total, because these companies don't do anything productive. They're investment companies. All they do is like.
They have meetings.
Which represent what percentage of the economy?
Right now?
About a quadrillion.
Of the GDP?
About a quadrillion.
It represents like 25%, 30% of our economy?
A quadrillion dollars worth globally.
Right now, there's not enough.
This process here, if the entire world economy is $50 trillion, in terms of GDP, 50 trillion, right? The debts created by this, $1 quadrillion.
But my question was the percentage of people, like how many offices that you've got that are people working just in the financial market.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to recycle those people into the productive sector.
Yeah.
Then. So this is why I understand that you want to doing like a big infrastructure deal,
yeah,
in order to recycle those people.
Yeah.
So far it represents 20% of the workforce.
The financial people?
Yeah.
In terms of the numbers,
I
don't think
it
is.
Well, there's a lot of offices that are financial buildings.
I would say
30%. I think there's a lot of
today. It becomes
no, more
and more
than
1%
of the workforce that are devoted for that. I think it's
30%.
Well, the important thing to
anyway,
you know how many people know who are involved in this?
Yeah, no, but when you're talking about, I mean, he's talking about everybody, every schmo who's working in an office for these guys.
You see, the generation of the baby boomers, or okay? This is roughly like 35% of the population today. The thing is, like 80% of the baby boomers in one side or another are involved in this operation. That's what you're saying. So your pension fund, some savings, some stocks, some mm-hmm. stuff, you're all involved in one way or another in this operation.
Well, maybe I see that the paper goes into,
you know, all this operation.
What happens later?
Real estate, you know, you're involved. So the
because
thing is, you're having a second job as well.
We should read maybe more of the paper.
But,
yeah.
You know, it's a big, it's the saving of
everything. What's the name of this document, article?
There's a lot of stuff to figure out, and these are good questions.
We're
going to
find out very
soon. And I don't know if
these people are going to be in the street soon, so we can count them.
But it's interesting, right?
Yeah.
But the thing, you can see the paradox, right? Where you have a massive increase in supposed value, but it actually exceeds what's being produced in actual wealth. Because there is no wealth in money. Money is not wealth. Wealth comes from productive activity. That is the basis for the value of money. It's the physical economy that gives value to money, not the other way around. And it will never be that way. It cannot be that way for physical reasons. You know, money is something that came after people were already producing things.
Okay, aside from the paper thing that it doesn't work. Aside from that, even if it would work, the way that we produce things and stuff, it's not sustainable for the planet anyway.
Well, that's because we're using slave labor. I mean, since you were born, since I was born, we have not had a sane economy. Since those times, the process of degeneration had already begun, right? And unless you were alive maybe when Kennedy was around, you don't know what a productive economy looks like, because from Nixon on, it's been destruction and lies and illusion and insanity, you know, overall. And the schools have been set up to teach that that's the way things are. But it, you know, obviously it's not. But
I think we should read this article as it continues to see, because first of all, let's put things into perspective right here. Most investments are not 50% gains, okay? In the economy,
right.
In a normal economy. This is an example. It uses the principle of what Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan were doing at the time in the last year, 1929. There was the most apotheosis of what they were doing with these things. And that's when this whole thing fell. It was not falling in regular speed. Now it was falling at leverage speed. Right? So if GM lost 5%, then all the other guys got a leverage fall. You know?
Can go leverage up,
works the other way.
Go leverage down.
Yeah, it works the other way too. Mm. You're leveraged on the way up 9 times. But you're also leveraged on the way down 9 times.
That's why he means that this is like the power of a cracking of a whip, because the whip at this end does not move so fast, but at the other end,
that's an tsunami effect.
Yeah. So
let me continue.
Yeah.
So you can see where investment B is now leveraged at 9 times, right? Investment company A was leveraged 3 times. Investment company B bought those leveraged stocks, and so they're leveraged actually nine times because of the setup. Using this principle of leverage, Goldman Sachs proceeded to establish 3 major investment trusts. Goldman Sachs Trading Company, starting in December 1928, Shenandoah Corp, and Blue Ridge Corp. Blue Ridge Corp bought the common stock of other companies, such as AT&T and Ford. In turn, Shenandoah Corp bought 86% ownership of the stock of Blue Ridge. And Goldman Sachs Trading Company, along with an allied partner, bought up 80% ownership of the stock in Shenandoah Corp.
By the time one gets up the ladder to Goldman Sachs Trading Company, one is getting leverage upon leverage upon leverage. Goldman Sachs Investment Bank owns and manages Goldman Sachs Trading Company. Thus, from this Ponzi scheme, Goldman Sachs raked in huge profits. But there is nothing real here. There is only paper based on other paper, based on other paper, as our friend here suspected. This Ponzi scheme jacked up the value of each of the three Goldman Sachs-run investment trusts, which in turn underpinned the rising value of the U.S. stock market. What did I say?
That's okay. I was trying to figure out what it meant.
Meanwhile, similar Ponzi schemes were being run by equally rock-ribbed conservative banks, such as J.P. Morgan, and the amount of leverage that was pumped into the U.S. stock market was enormous. Other leveraging was coming into the market through things like margin debt and borrowing. But having manufactured profits for itself out of the clear blue sky, Goldman Sachs could not stop there. Quickly, it developed a cash hoard in Goldman Sachs Trading Company. The goal became to pollute other parts of the economy. So you see, they build up all of this paper, but they know that the paper itself isn't worth much. They have to pollute other parts of the economy. It's like money laundering or something. The goal became to pollute other parts of the economy. Goldman Sachs used the cash hoard to go on a spree, buying up commercial banks. Goldman Sachs bought the controlling stock in Manufacturers Trust, the forerunner of Manufacturers Hanover Trust, one of the most powerful banks in America. It compounded that by buying up Pacific Trust Company, Foreman State Bank of Chicago, and American Trust Company of San Francisco. Not pausing to catch its breath, it bought up three insurance companies. It also had some of the banks that it had taken over put in money to help take over the insurance companies. There was now an incestuous ring among investment bank Goldman Sachs, some commercial banks, and some insurance companies. Goldman Sachs then turned to the next round of looting. It was one of the top bond trading firms in the company. It underwrote and traded bonds for industrial companies, for which it earned a fee. It instructed the commercial banks and insurance companies, which had been gobbled up, "You will buy these industrial bonds." They complied, even if it was not in their own interests. In the case of commercial banks, they were now putting their depositors' funds at risk to buy these bonds. In the case of insurance companies, they were spending their policyholders' money to buy these bonds. Goldman Sachs then took some of its spare cash, lent it to its captive commercial banks, charging them rates as high as 20%, so that the commercial banks would, in turn, lend it as call money to speculators who were playing the stock market. The whole Ponzi scheme came tumbling down. Shenandoah Corp, which had been trading at $36 per share in July 1929, fell to 53 cents in July 1932. The rapid deleveraging of Goldman Sachs' empire helped topple the financial markets. Others were involved, too, in producing this outcome. There was the criminal behavior of Charles E. Mitchell, the head of National City Bank, today Citigroup, Citicorp. This was paralleled by criminal behavior of Albert H. Wiggin, head of Chase National Bank, today Chase Manhattan, and so forth.
Do you want me to read? Yeah. So bankers horrified over Glass-Steagall. On March 4th, 1933, Franklin Roosevelt was sworn in as president. Within days, Congress was meeting in session. Some of the broad outlines of the bankers' depredations had already been discovered, and the Fletcher-Pecora hearings brought more to light. The nation was still experiencing a financial downturn 3.5 years after the October 1929 stock market crash. The financier oligarchs had had their day. President Roosevelt and some others decided it was time to assert national sovereignty. The Fletcher-Pecora hearings had revealed some of the elements of the Goldman Sachs story and had shed light on the danger of a single financial institution mingling the activity of a commercial bank with that of an investment bank brokerage firm with that of an insurance company. Prior to the 1929 crash, Goldman Sachs' power had grown to such an extent that few could have checked it. The Glass-Steagall Act aimed to take apart a pivotal part of the power. Its official name was the Banking Act of 1933, but it soon popularly bore the names of its two sponsors, Senator Carter Glass of Virginia, a senior member of the Senate Banking Committee, and Representative Henry Steagall from Alabama, the chairman of the House Banking Committee. The act stated that no single institution or bank holding company could engage in both commercial banking and brokerage investment banking. No commercial bank could own an investment bank or carry out the functions of an investment bank. Sections 16 and 21 of the Act stated that no commercial bank could engage in the business of issuing, underwriting, selling, or distributing at wholesale or retail or through syndicate participation, stock, bonds, debentures, notes, and other securities. The exception is that commercial banks can sell and underwrite U.S. government bonds. The sale, syndication, and of securities is the domain of investment banks. On the same grounds, no investment bank could take individual small customer deposits, which is the domain of the commercial bank. Neither commercial nor investment bank could own an insurance company. The bankers understood that an important part of the cycle of the 1920s was being broken. W.C. Potter of the Morgan Bank-controlled Guarantee Trust characterized the proposal as quite the most disastrous he had ever heard. The American Bankers Association led the fight against the bill to the last ditch, in its president's words. The bill carried another useful provision. It created the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp, FDIC, which gave federal insurance for citizens' bank deposits up to a certain amount, for the first time in nation's history. It announced that starting July 1, 1934, all deposits under $10,000 would be insured 100%. Deposits in the range of $10,000 to $50,000 would be insured 75%, and deposits of $50,000 and larger would be insured 50%. But today, all deposits up to $100,000 are insured 100%. To counter some of the other practices of the 1920s, the bill also forbade any bank officer from borrowing from its own institution. In mid-June 1933, the Glass-Steagall legislation passed both the House of Representatives and the Senate by overwhelming margins, and President Roosevelt signed it on June 16. The act, though carrying a powerful punch, was limited in its scope to curtailing certain abuses. It became part of a package that included the Truth in Securities Act. This required full disclosure in the issue of new securities to the public. Heavy penalties would be levied for failure to give full and accurate information about securities to the government. This became law on May 27, 1933. Also, the Securities Exchange Act. This set up the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, to regulate and oversee the securities markets. Certain manipulative practices, such as washed sales and matched orders, were prohibited. Insider trading was eliminated. This became law on June 6, 1934. None of the laws were comprehensive. Some were better than others in addressing individual problems or in addressing the larger picture. Yet together they move in the direction of asserting national sovereignty on behalf of the general welfare and against the oligarchy. This provoked a fight with Wall Street, with some of the other necessary initiatives, but some of the other necessary initiatives never made it through Congress. At the same time, other legislation was being passed to reverse the downturn in the financial system, to build infrastructure, provide jobs, and restore the physical economy. The oligarchy's counterattack. The oligarchy saw Glass-Steagall as hitting a vital nerve.
So that was the 1930s.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the oligarchy saw Glass-Steagall as hitting a...
Because...
Yeah.
Maybe you have questions. Okay.
The oligarchy saw Glass-Steagall as hitting a vital nerve and began a process of chipping away at it. One of the biggest moves in that direction was the passage of the Garn-Saint-Germain Depository Institutions Act, which passed in October 1982 and deregulated the entire U.S. banking system. The act did not address Glass-Steagall, but it had a deleterious effect on the Glass-Steagall provisions and the principle of regulation. Garn-Saint-Germain helped eliminate usury ceilings, along with the high interest rates imposed by Federal Reserve Board Chairman Paul Volcker in October 1979. It pushed the Savings and Loan Association into the crisis that would befall them in the 1980s. So it also pushed the United States into this direction of increased emphasis on speculation and reduced agriculture and manufacturing production, which weakened the financial system and the economy as a whole. So,
but the system was able to survive because they were pumping all the other countries at that time.
Yes, the thing is,
this is what it was, camouflage.
Yes, the thing is, there was engaged in the whole disintegration of the economy, but there was also speculation on...
The thing is, in 1971, what Nixon did, he destroyed the regulated international financial system. So if you're looking at the history of the exchange rate between the Canadian and the US dollar, until 1971, it's a straight line. You know, the exchange is dollar to the US dollar to the Canadian dollar. The ratio never changed, it's a straight line. After this, you have this fluctuation. What's happening is when you have this fluctuation system, you can lend the money to Mexico, US dollar, and you have to reimburse me the US dollar. In the moment when I devalue your currency, what's happening, you have to pay, produce twice as much to reimburse the same amount of dollars, right? So this became a looting mechanism which was imposed over the third world nations who destroyed their ability to grow. And this is part of the process of fitting this bubble. That's how this happened. This means once I get the strongest dollar, I can go back to your country and I can purchase physical goods produced by the Mexicans under discount rate.
Mm-hmm.
So their products become much cheaper than product produced in Canada. De facto is no, because you see, physical process, the physical laws are the same in Mexico like here.
The physical
this
universal.
This is a big secret, okay?
Sweating to
yes. So to fit a guy your size, it requires the same amount of calorie, right? To produce, to melt the steel is happening in 550 degree temperature. So the thing is, if you make a car, it requires the same amount of energy to put the parts, put the tire, put the glasses, the window, the windshields. So the thing is, the car, in physical term, to be produced there or produced here is the same thing. Why the Mexican car can be cheaper? You see? So the thing is, this cheap labor thing, the way that's the way how they're mystifying it, but it's a straightforward slavery we were having in 1800.
No,
it's like 15 minutes or what? 15 minutes.
Yeah, let's finish.
Finish it. But basically, we don't have to finish the whole thing.
It's not very much more.
Yeah.
This is your end. Just two paragraphs.
Okay. So, so in 1985 and 1986, the comptroller of the currency engaged in a duplicitous reading of the Glass-Steagall Act to allow national banks to purchase and sell mutual funds. In 1987, the comptroller of the currency concluded that the national bank may offer to the public, through a subsidiary, brokerage services and investment advice. So you see the little chipping away at it. In April 1987, the Federal Board of Governors interpreted a section of Glass-Steagall to allow underwriting activities if they were conducted through a securities subsidiary, not principally engaged in underwriting. This was interpreted to mean not earning more than 5% of revenues therefrom. Step by step, agencies sympathetic to the banks were rolling back the legislation. In April 1998, Citicorp, a commercial bank, and Travelers Salomon Smith Barney, Travelers is an insurance company, Salomon Smith Barney is an investment bank, merged. These two companies merged, an insurance company and a commercial bank, and an investment bank, sorry. Yeah, so all three. They merged, thumbing their noses at Glass-Steagall. Now, as a result of the speculative activity, the banking financial system is on the verge of a breakdown. Several orders of magnitude larger than anything that occurred in 1929 to 1932. The same Wall Street firms that contributed to the 1929-32 meltdown and ensuing depression have built a bubble bigger than that of the late 1920s. Today, they are using leveraged derivatives. In 1999, America is burdened by $55 trillion of derivatives outstanding, of which the financial institutions own more than 90%. In the 1920s, there weren't even 150 million of these instruments. Today, the Wall Street forces are carrying out an incredible array of corporate mergers. In 1998, mergers took place to the tune of $1.6 trillion. In 1929, less than $15 billion. So this is the worst possible time to repeal Glass-Steagall or to undermine Glass-Steagall and the very principle of regulation of the financial system. The Graham-Leach-Bliley Financial Modernization Act will concentrate enormous speculative power into the hands of 15 to 20 institutions. Along with the Federal Reserve Board, they will have control over every facet of financial life. This will speed up the process of looting and dissolution. A nation that tolerates such a retrogressive step has abandoned its moral fitness to survive.
So this is a document we published in 1999. That's what we are printing and we are producing, because the people can understand the principle of the speculation. And you can see actually what we were saying back then, how it came to fruition. So you can better understand this entire process, because the banks are collapsing around.
Is there any notions that we should know before reading all this document? Because you kind of explained everything, but I kind of like misunderstood.
I think like it takes some reading. Like a few times, maybe you can read.
Yeah.
But
would I understand if I read it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you should.
Just the notions of the difference in the species of paper, like the fact that bonds, you're not necessarily going to get the same returns as...
Oh, really? Okay.
But there has not been any video documents, you know, like you could do it like just joking with blocks, you know, I mean, in a way that for the common people to understand, I guess someone must have done that, I mean...
I guess we try. We try, but one thing that we're not going to do, and I think it's important not to, is to sort of dumb down the idea of something to help it be understood. You know what I mean? part of the process of reaching out to the public and organizing the public is to lift people's